content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated February 10, 2025. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in white capital, large block lettering, superimposed upon what is probably a depiction of the interior of the Oval Office in the White House. Blue sky in the background, white paned window, gold drapes in front of which sits President Donald Trump, and the caption reads, "He's back." Beginning with the D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. Even before the Middle East ceasefire agreement had been put to page and circulated among the many anxious stakeholders, the question of credit was already at the fore. It was, as with most things dealing with that region and Washington's tentacles into it, anything but an easy verdict. As President Joe Biden, January 15, finished announcing the deal that would potentially end a 15-month war in Gaza, a reporter asked the Twilight leader in the White House entry hall, "Who gets credit for this, you or Trump?" A puzzled Biden turned around and asked if the query was a joke. It clearly was not, nor did it carry a clear answer. The unlikely and uncomfortable answer is each man carried some responsibility for the agreement. The deal, which pushes pause on the slog of a fight between the Israelis and Hamas, started in phases that kick off with hostage for prisoner trades and a 6-week ceasefire, and was a byproduct of complicated diplomacy back in the U.S., with Biden's team working closely with President-elect Donald Trump's incoming team and regional partners in Doha. The twofold U.S. cooperation between otherwise rival camps came after a hard-fought election in which both sides offered competing visions of peace in the Middle East, and which key leaders in the region were closely monitoring. It is not a stretch to say the election year calendar in the U.S. likely dragged out the negotiations far longer than might have been seen during an apolitical season. Ultimately, both Biden and Trump played their hands, and historians will mull for generations which Paul had the bigger role. Each sought to claim credit right away. Trump, preempting Biden's announcement, said the deal only happened as a result of our historic victory in November. For his part, Biden sought to cast the breakthrough as something that dated back to his framework announced in May and was only realized in recent weeks because of his team's persistence. And he proved to be in the job when the deal came together, calling it one of the toughest negotiations I have ever experienced. Despite Trump's insistence that he was to credit for the deal, his envoy, Steve Witkoff, made clear to reporters that Biden hand Brett McGurk was the man with the brief. The cooperation between the outgoing and incoming teams was hardly the stuff of buddy films, but both teams rightly noted the crisis demanded it. with Trump's campaigns and Biden's public service both over for all practical purposes, the credit question is mostly one that feeds egos, not scoreboards. In perhaps the oddest final chapter twist, Trump probably helped Biden get one last win as president, and Biden likely set in motion the first victory of Trump's second term. It is tough to imagine either finds much pleasure in that piece of the history, but sometimes that make-it-work ethos is what the office requires and finds. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, Iran's Shaky Regime. It has been a disastrous few months for Iran and its ability to threaten its regional rivals and enemies. Israel's security forces have crippled the leadership of Iran's two most potent allied militias, Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon. The surprise collapse of Bashar Assad's government in Syria not only cost Iran its most important state ally, but also cut off the route it has used to supply Hezbollah with weapons and support. Yemen's Houthi rebels continue to attack shipping traffic through the Red Sea, but an emboldened Israel has scored direct hits against its fighters, including inside Yemen itself. Iran has also recognized Russia, its most important ally outside the Middle East, is so preoccupied with Ukraine that Moscow's needs outstrip its generosity. In short, Iran has seen the collapse of its regional empire by proxy, the so-called axis of resistance. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ordered direct strikes on Iranian territory in 2024, knowing there was little Tehran could do to retaliate. Donald Trump, a man who has long argued that Iran responds only to maximum pressure, is now once again President of the United States. He doesn't want a costly all-out war with Iran, but will be watching closely for any sign its leaders might attempt a push to build a nuclear bomb. There's also the temptation, both on the U.S. and Israeli side, to extend maximum pressure into military action. Iran's domestic problems might pose an even greater threat to leaders of the Islamic Republic. Its sanction-plagued economy is running on fumes. The value of its currency is spiraling. Inflation now tops 30%, and a broad range of Iran's people are understandably growing angrier. The latest public frustration has focused on an energy crisis that has forced sporadic blackouts and the closure of schools and businesses to conserve natural gas, which supplies most of the country's power and heat. The economy has been so incompetently and corruptly managed that Iran, which has the world's second largest natural gas reserves, faces severe shortages. It is left to burn oil to fill the gap and has some of the world's most polluted cities. The regime's ongoing attempts to reimpose draconian social rules and censorship laws have re-energized the protesters who powered the 2022-2023 Woman Life Freedom demonstrations. For many Iranians, aggressive police enforcement of laws that require women to wear the hijab adds insult to the injuries inflicted by Iran's economic isolation. Just 50% of voters took part in last year's presidential election, a low figure for Iran. Dissatisfaction is now percolating, even among the regime's hardline supporters, frustrated that Iran did so little to save Syria's Assad from a humiliating flight to Moscow. Iran spent billions in recent years to bolster Assad's ability to survive his country's civil war. That investment is now burned. It has fallen to Masoud Pezeshkian, Iran's reformist president to manage these failures. The embattled president still has the all-important institutional support of Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei and the politically powerful Speaker of Parliament Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf. But a growing number of Iranians, once hopeful that Pezeshkian might bring positive change, now see him as a weak leader. And in the background looms an increasingly large question. Who will take power when Khamenei, now 85 and suffering from prostate cancer, dies? Power brokers within the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps and the clerical establishment have had years to prepare for succession. But this will be the first transfer of supreme power in Iran since 1989, and just the second in the Islamic Republic's 45-year history. Some inside the U.S. and Israeli governments argue the regime in Tehran is close enough to the brink that a well-timed push might drive it into the abyss. But though Iran is a wounded lion, its massive missile and drone arsenal keep its claws sharp. If its leaders feel pushed into a corner, abroad or at home, they can still take actions that plunge the region and draw the U.S. into another war. That is how Iran's weakness could become the world's problem. There's a small photo inset here. It is in color, but it shows a row of really elderly gentlemen filing through a doorway. They're all wearing dark blue suits, light blue shirts. I don't see any neckties or headgear. They all either have gray, white, or graying hair. The caption reads, Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian at UN headquarters in New York City, September 24, 2024. Trump's return, this is under the politics heading. A double spread here of photograph. I think it's one photograph. Reading from left to right, J.D. Vance, Donald Trump, Joe Biden in the front row. In the second row, Jill Biden, Doug Emhoff, and a person whom I don't quite recognize, with other individuals standing, but in a seated area behind the first three individuals. This is a very long article, which I will abbreviate. Well, actually, it's not very long. The disruptor in chief is back. Donald Trump and the Constitution meet again, by Massimo Calabresi. Lost amid the hullabaloo surrounding Donald J. Trump's second inauguration as President of the United States, the last-minute, cold-driven venue changes. The galas and balls, the $170 million raised from donors, both big-name and anonymous, is the point of the whole extravaganza. In the summer of 1787, the delegates to the Federal Convention in Philadelphia included in the document they were drafting a requirement that before taking office, the president should recite the following oath. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Not everyone thought it was a good idea. Several delegates believed oaths were pointless, almost superstitious. It is the only verbatim pledge in the U.S. Constitution, and in retrospect it speaks to the document's fragility, a sense that the men struggling in secret in Philadelphia were worried their hard-won agreement was so tenuous it required a promise from future leaders to respect their work. Yet every president, from George Washington on, has recited the 35 words as a commitment to the rule of law in the face of unpredictable forces of change. Trump, of course, is himself an unpredictable force for change. Whatever one thinks of him, he has altered America in ways unimaginable a decade ago. Back then, the so-called Washington consensus among Republicans and Democrats held that free trade was a near-absolute good. Presidents respected prosecutorial independence as a way of protecting citizens from an elected leaders trying to use the power of law enforcement for personal interests. For 75 years, commanders-in-chief upheld the U.S. pledge of mutual defense with its NATO allies. Trump has cast these norms aside, and the consequences are rippling around the world. He's arguably the most influential change agent to occupy the White House since Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Yet the 47th president is as much a product of global change as a driver of it. The challenges his agenda attempts to address accumulated over decades and are now greater than can be mastered by any one leader or even one country. Transnational forces, from migration to organized crime to pandemics, have resisted both collaborative and unilateral responses since before 9/11. Today's world is in many ways unrecognizable from what it was when America won the Cold War. In China, the U.S. faces a potential economic and military competitor unlike any before. Trump has pledged to solve these challenges through a suite of aggressive moves. He promises everything from mass deportations to suppression of the free media through prosecution to the annexation of Greenland, the Panama Canal, and Canada, though he may be joking about the last bit. Supporters say his norm breaking will be worth it if he succeeds where others have failed, and they credit him for promising to tackle big, difficult problems, cutting government waste and reversing massive deficits, ending wars in the Middle East and Ukraine, fixing the long broken immigration system. Trump took office in as strong a political position as ever before, buoyed by a decisive election victory and near record-high public support, a Republican Congress unified behind him, and broader backing in the business community, most notably among tech elites, who've committed this time to working with him. Too many, Trump's ascension carries the possibility of positive change for institutions that have grown stagnant or worse. His opponents, meanwhile, are in the process of figuring out which parts of his agenda to accept. Over time, Democrats have adopted some of the Trump prescriptions they once denounced. President Biden kept many of Trump's China tariffs. Vice President Kamala Harris embraced his no tax on tips pledge during her campaign. 48 House Democrats voted for the Laken-Riley Act, which requires federal detention for anyone in the country illegally who's arrested for shoplifting or theft. 12 of their Democratic colleagues in the Senate backed the bill. At the same time, Democrats are preparing to battle over many of Trump's policies, as they have for the past 10 years. The key moments of Trump's second term will come when the forces of political resistance, his own advisors, the legal system, or his fellow world leaders oppose the president's moves. Trump has threatened to deploy the military against American protesters. Will he abide by judicial rulings if an aide tells him the courts cannot force him to? It is unclear what use Trump intends to make of the partial immunity from criminal prosecution the Supreme Court granted presidents last year. Trump told Time last fall, "I will only do what the law allows, but I will go up to the maximum level of what the law allows." His most anxious critics point out he's not exactly a man of his word. He changes positions and discards allies at the drop of a hat. He's already named and replaced his White House counsel before even taking office. The 47th president is the first to enter office as a felon, convicted less than a year ago by a jury of his peers of 34 counts of falsifying business records. Reciting a simple oath does not seem like much assurance that he will abide by the Constitution. But the hard-won agreement for governing the U.S. has shown itself a survivor. It's endured the Civil War, the rise of fascism, pandemics, extra-legal affronts. It emerged from the disruptions and disgraces of Trump's first presidency, too, including the events culminating in the Capitol riot, January 6, 2021. As he takes office for the second time, the pledge at the center of his inauguration spectacle now seems less an expression of insecurity by the framers than one of wisdom, and those anxious about what is coming can be glad that on August 27, 1787, the convention delegates decided to broaden their original version of the president's oath from a simple promise to faithfully execute the duties of the office to a further commitment to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. It is on Trump and America to ensure that oath is kept. Acting fast, this is still in politics, a survey of some of Trump's first actions in office by Miranda J.R. Retnam and Chad DeGuzman. Constitutionally, the president cannot create laws, but he does have broad authority to direct how the federal agencies enforce them. And within hours of his inauguration, President Trump set out to fulfill a number of his campaign promises by using that authority, issuing a spate of presidential actions on everything from the border to federal building architecture. The White House's website lists 46 presidential actions, July 20. The first four were administration staffing announcements. Of the rest, 26 were executive orders, 12 were memorandums, and 4 were proclamations. What these different types of presidential actions mean and how much authority they each carry is not always clear. Many are also likely to face swift challenges in court. Here are some of the day one executive actions to watch. Proclamation on flying flags at half staff. After former President Jimmy Carter died December 29, President Biden issued a proclamation for flags to be flown at half staff for 30 days at all public buildings. Trump, however, expressed his displeasure at the idea of flags being flown at half staff on the day of his inauguration, prompting Republican Speaker of the House Mike Johnson and a number of Republican governors to order flags to be flown at full staff January 20 at the Capitol and state buildings. As his first move back in office, Trump issued a proclamation that ordered flags to be flown at full staff on all inauguration days, including the current one. Executive order rescinding previous executive orders. In one action, Trump revoked 78 executive orders and memorandums issued by the Biden administration, many to do with diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives and the climate crisis. Memorandum on emergency price relief. Without outlining any specific measures, Trump directed executive departments and agencies to implement so-called emergency price relief to lower the cost of housing, health care, food, and fuel. Executive orders withdrawing from international agreements. Trump effectively withdrew the U.S. from the landmark Paris Agreement, which focuses on reducing countries' carbon emissions. In separate orders, Trump also withdrew from the World Health Organization and an agreement for a universal corporate minimum tax. Proclamation pardoning January 6 rioters, Trump pardoned or commuted the sentences of all who faced criminal charges related to the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol by his supporters, and he ordered the dismissal of all pending January 6 indictments, a sweeping directive thought to cover over 1,500 people. Executive order delaying TikTok ban. The U.S. ban of Chinese-owned video app TikTok, which was passed with broad bipartisan support by Congress and unanimously upheld by the Supreme Court, was delayed for 75 days. Executive order revoking security clearances. Trump revoked security clearances of more than four dozen former intelligence officials who signed a 2020 letter saying info purportedly from one of Hunter Biden's laptops smacked of a Russian information operation. Proclamation declaring a national emergency at the southern border. Trump called for military personnel and resources to help secure the southern border, including through additional physical barriers. In other actions aimed at migrants, he claimed the U.S. is facing an invasion at the U.S.-Mexico border, suspended the U.S. refugee resettlement program, and restricted federal funds for so-called sanctuary jurisdictions. Executive order expanding the use of the death penalty, calling for a more aggressive use of the death penalty. Trump instructed the Attorney General to pursue it for all federal capital crimes and to encourage state prosecutors to do the same. Biden issued commutations for 37 of 40 federal death row inmates in December, an action that Trump cannot reverse. Executive order to restrict visa seekers from certain countries. This order, reminiscent of the so-called Muslim travel ban from Trump's first presidential term, intensifies the vetting and screening of visa seekers, particularly those aliens coming from regions or nations with identified security risks, as well as refugees or stateless persons. Executive order establishing DOGE. Trump renamed the U.S. Digital Service as the Department of Government Efficiency, a new agency he controversially promised to create and install Elon Musk as head of. The non-governmental advisory bodies already facing multiple lawsuits, including one alleging that DOGE violates the Federal Advisory Committee Act. Executive order defining gender, outlining federal definitions of women and girls as females and men and boys as males. Trump defined male and female as biological, binary, and immutable. This order set in motion the rollback of Biden-era guidance about transgender people and gender identity, including certain Title IX protections. Executive order to rename Denali and the Gulf of Mexico. Trump directed the Secretary of the Interior to rename the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America and return the name of Denali, North America's highest mountain, the name of which honors its sacredness to Alaska Natives, to its former name, Mount McKinley. Citizenship at risk. The fight over birthright citizenship has already begun by Brian Bennett. One of the most controversial executive actions Donald Trump signed on his first day as president took direct aim at the Constitution, challenging the idea that people born inside the U.S. are guaranteed citizenship. Trump told federal departments to deny what is known as birthright citizenship to children born to mothers and fathers in the country unlawfully. His order would also deny citizenship to children born to parents in the U.S. on work or study visas, tourism visas, or when neither parent is a U.S. citizen or permanent resident. If it stands, the changes would go into effect February 19. Within hours, Trump's action was challenged in court as unconstitutional. A coalition of immigrant rights groups, having expected Trump's move, filed a lawsuit that night, asking a federal court in New Hampshire to declare the order unlawful and stop the federal government from implementing it. The framers of the 14th Amendment specifically enshrined this principle in our Constitution's text to ensure that no one, not even the president, could deny children born in America their rightful place as citizens, read the lawsuit. The next day, the attorneys general for 22 Democratic-led states, Washington, D.C., and the city of San Francisco joined in, filing similar suits. Trump's order hinges on persuading courts to upend a century and a half of judicial rulings by accepting his interpretation of a single clause in the 14th Amendment. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. The key phrase there is subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Trump's order instructs agencies to consider those it targets as being not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. That reading flies in the face of settled law, says Evan Burnick, associate professor of law at Northern Illinois University and co-author of The Original Meaning of the 14th Amendment, Its Letter and Spirit. The amendment was first proposed in the wake of the Civil War by black activists and abolitionists. The Republican Party decided it should be enshrined in the Constitution in order to protect the citizenship rights of formerly enslaved people and their descendants. Burnick says it was purposely written to be sweeping and broad in scope. The exception to automatic citizenship intended through the phrase subject to the jurisdiction thereof primarily applies to children of foreign diplomats. The phrasing was debated when it was written, and the intended exceptions were made intentionally narrow, Burnick says. The new administration's interpretation, he argues, ignores both the text and that history. Nonetheless, the legal fight over the order is widely expected to end up at the Supreme Court. Ukraine in the balance. Biden's foreign policy win was Zelensky's loss, by Simon Schuster. When Russia invaded Ukraine nearly 3 years ago, President Joe Biden set three objectives for the U.S. response. Ukraine's victory was never among them. The phrase the White House used to describe its mission at the time, supporting Ukraine for as long as it takes, was intentionally vague. It also raised the question, as long as it takes to do what? We were deliberately not talking about the territorial parameters, says Eric Green, who served on Biden's National Security Council at the time, overseeing Russia policy. The U.S., in other words, made no promise to help Ukraine recover all of the land Russia occupied, and certainly not the vast territories in eastern Ukraine and the Crimean Peninsula taken in 2014. The reason was simple, Green says. In the White House's view, doing so was beyond Ukraine's ability, even with robust help from the West. That was not going to be a success story ultimately. The more important objective was for Ukraine to survive as a sovereign, democratic country, free to pursue integration with the West. That was the first of Biden's objectives. He also wanted the U.S. and its allies to remain united, and he insisted on avoiding direct conflict between Russia and NATO. looking back on his leadership during the war in Ukraine, certain to shape his legacy as a statesman, Biden has achieved all that, but success on those limited terms provides little satisfaction, even to some of his closest allies and advisors. It is unfortunately the kind of success where you don't feel great about it, Green says in an interview with Time, because there's so much suffering for Ukraine and so much uncertainty about where it's ultimately going to land. For the Ukrainians, disappointment with Biden has been building throughout the invasion, and they've expressed it ever more openly since the U.S. presidential elections ended in Donald Trump's victory. In a podcast that aired in early January, President Volodymyr Zelensky said the U.S. had not done enough under Biden to impose sanctions against Russia and to provide Ukraine with weapons and security guarantees. With all due respect to the United States and the administration, Zelensky told Lex Fridman, I don't want the same situation like we had with Biden. I ask for sanctions now, please, and weapons now. The criticism was unusually pointed and seems all the more remarkable given how much support the U.S. has given Ukraine during Biden's tenure. $66 billion in military assistance alone since the February 2022 Russian invasion, according to the U.S. State Department. Combine that with all the aid Congress has approved for Ukraine's economic, humanitarian, and other needs, and the total comes to around $183 billion as of last September, according to Ukraine Oversight, a U.S. government watchdog created to monitor and account for all of this assistance. Yet Zelensky and some of his allies insist the U.S. has been too cautious in standing up to Russia, especially when it comes to granting Ukraine a clear path to NATO membership. It's very important that we share the same vision for Ukraine's security future in the EU and NATO, the Ukrainian president said during his most recent visit to the White House in September. During that visit, Zelensky gave Biden a detailed list of requests that he described as Ukraine's victory plan. Apart from calling for an invitation to join NATO, the plan urged the U.S. to strengthen Ukraine's position in the war with a massive new influx of weapons and the permission to use them deep inside Russian territory. Biden had by then announced he would not run for re-election, and the Ukrainians hoped his lame duck status would free him to make bolder decisions, in part to secure his legacy in foreign affairs. For us, his legacy is an argument, a senior member of Zelensky's delegation to Washington told Time. How will history remember you? The appeals got a mixed reception. On the question of Ukraine's NATO membership, Biden would not budge, but he did sign off on a number of moves the White House has long rejected as too dangerous. In November, the U.S. allowed Ukraine to use American missiles to strike inside Russian territory. And in January, the Biden administration imposed tough sanctions against the Russian energy sector, including the shadow fleet of tankers Russia has used to export its oil. While these decisions fell short of what Zelensky wanted, they helped Biden make the case during the last foreign policy speech of his tenure that the U.S. had met its goals in defending Ukraine. He remained careful, however, not to promise Ukraine would regain any more of its territory or even survive to the end of this war. Russian President Vladimir Putin has failed thus far to subjugate Ukraine, Biden said in his address at the State Department January 13. Today, Ukraine is still a free, independent country with the potential for a bright future. The future that Zelensky and many of his countrymen have in mind is one in which Russia's defeated. But in rallying the world to fight, the implication Biden embedded in his own goals was that defending Ukraine against Russia is not the same as defeating Russia. So it is not surprising if that goal remains far from Zelensky's reach. The Myth That Broke America. Essay by Adam Chandler, adapted from Chandler's 99% Perspiration, A New Working History of the American Way of Life. The Myth That Broke America, How a National Story About Opportunity Created a Civic Crisis, by Adam Chandler. When President Trump delivered his second inaugural address, he preserved a tradition of myth-making that has only served Americans poorly. Beyond the expected theatrics, Trump declared the U.S. to be history's greatest civilization, despite its fixture as the most unequal nation with the lowest life expectancy, even just among Western democracies of today. And despite his record-thin margin of victory in November's election, the president claimed the entire nation is rapidly unifying behind our agenda. What is actually noteworthy about this moment, however, is a rare current of agreement among Americans. The consensus comes in the form of a deep pessimism about our most cherished national story. One recent poll of American voters conducted by WSJ/NORC found that only 36% still believe in an American dream. Broadly defined by the idea that hard work begets success and upward mobility. This finding represents a big tumble downward from 2012, when even in the shadow of the Great Recession, 52% of Americans still held fast to that story. Historically, to be American, for some at least, meant the chance to live free of class stasis and feudal baggage. Even before the term was coined, an American dream of being socially mobile by means of hard work dusted industriousness with a special merit-driven magic that seduced and frustrated millions. From the pilgrims and founding fathers through the frontier and all the way to today's hustle culture, gig economy, and ragged safety net, the essential American folktale has plated hard work with destiny, self-reliance, and with self-actualization, and success with moral worth. But while the narrative around opportunity has largely remained fixed, the American experience has degraded from one of bootstrapping to one of white-knuckling. Over the past 45 years, the U.S. economy has doubled in size, and American workers have grown 81% more productive, while their wages have grown only 29%, according to the Economic Policy Institute. Workers of color and workers without college degrees have seen their real wages decline. Today, medical debt is the biggest cause of bankruptcy in America, and baby formula is one of the most shoplifted items. According to a Brookings Institution study, 44% of Americans work jobs that qualify as low wage. These are some of the faith-shredding headwinds that made arguments about preserving democracy fall flat for people already failed by a democracy where hard work does not pay off. They're the same winds that have rustled Trump back into power. And we are learning again from the Capitol Rotunda to Southern California, winds can very easily carry fires. The roiled, R-O-I-L-E-D, opposition, Democrats cannot agree on what to do next, by Philip Elliott. When Senator John Fetterman got word that President-elect Donald Trump wanted to meet, the Pennsylvania Democrat did not have to think it over too long. Even though Trump had savaged Fetterman during the 2022 campaign, going so far as to allege he had an affinity for cocaine, heroin, crystal meth, and fentanyl, Fetterman reasoned he represents all Pennsylvanians, including the 3.5 million who had just voted for Trump. If the president invites you to have a conversation and to engage, I'm not sure why anybody would decide not to, Fetterman tells Time. I'm in the business of creating wins for Pennsylvania. And so, the weekend before Trump returned to the White House, Fetterman jumped on a plane to Florida to spend about an hour with Trump at Mar-a-Lago. The two talked about immigration, the sale of Pittsburgh-based U.S. Steel, the detention of Pennsylvania native Mark Fogel in Russia on drug charges. For Fetterman, it was about starting the next 4 years on productive footing. There's plenty of things that we can work together on, and there are parts where we are not agreeing, Fetterman says, and I am going to avoid just jumping online and just dropping a lot of cheap heat. 8 years earlier, such a meeting would have drawn outrage in Democratic circles. This time, the response to Fetterman's pilgrimage, which caught most senior Democrats by surprise, was more ambivalent. Some party officials believe working more closely with Trump this time will be necessary as the 47th president takes office with political capital to spend and a Republican Congress lined up behind him. At the start of Trump's second term, the Democrats are stuck somewhere between discombobulation and despair. Conversations with 24 Democratic sources reveal a party still struggling to figure out how they found themselves losing the White House and Senate and stuck in the minority in the House. Prescriptions for a comeback abound, a more inclusive message, not just what plays well among activists and on college campuses. More spending on state parties and less on D.C.-based consultants. Serious investments in a progressive media ecosystem to rival the conservative one. A foreign policy that's as easy to explain as Republicans tried and true peace through strength. Better polling. Less fear-mongering about the end of democracy, more podcasts. But those are all hunches at this point, ahead of any comprehensive, sanctioned autopsy. In fact, some Democrats fear the party's in danger of overreacting to Kamala Harris's loss. They point to how bad a year 2024 was for incumbents around the world, from the UK to Botswana. They stress recent inflation made incumbents vulnerable, regardless of political leaning, allowing opposition figures in nations such as Panama, India, South Africa, and Japan to make significant inroads. Others point to the promise of Democratic groups like suburban powerhouse Red, Wine, and Blue, and recruitment machines like Swing Left, which are notching successes for candidates further down the ballot. As the debate churns, some say any plan remains premature. You can write a eulogy before someone dies. You cannot write an autopsy until the body's on the table, says Jesse Ferguson, a strategist who formerly ran House Democrats' outside spending program. In other words, the version of the Democratic Party that got killed in 2024 is still twitching, and the fact that no one in the party can agree on how to deal with Trump 2.0 or decide if Fetterman's meeting was a shrewd move, a betrayal, or both, means Democrats are still at a loss for how to prevent more casualties. A party strategist who has been among those searching for a way out of the wilderness has a PowerPoint he's been delivering since Election Day. The slides are meant to cheer his fellow Democrats up, starting with a grim New York Times story with the headline, "Baffled in Loss, Democrats Seek Road Forward." The piece begins, "The Democratic Party emerged from this week's election, struggling over what it stood for, anxious about its political future, bewildered about how to compete with a Republican Party that some Democrats say may be headed for a period of electoral dominance." The next slide reveals the date of that verdict, November 7, 2004. 2 years later, Nancy Pelosi became Speaker of the House. 2 years after that, Barack Obama was elected the nation's first black president. From the ashes of John Kerry's defeat by George W. Bush, Democrats forged a successful comeback. The strategist who's been delivering this message to colleagues and clients says the point is Democrats can recover quickly if they figure out the right lessons from the defeat. Yet those gains 20 years ago were driven by two primary factors: the presence of Bush, who grew increasingly unpopular amid the Iraq War, and the rise of a transcendent political talent. As another strategist, Chris Moyer, a former aide to Democratic Senate leader Harry Reid, puts it, "You cannot wait around for Obama to come around. We cannot act like it's just going to happen. We have to make it happen ourselves." In the meantime, Democrats are at odds over how to respond to a second Trump presidency. The so-called resistance that propelled Democrats during his first term seems weary, if not depleted. In Congress, party leaders are settling into a strategy that focuses more on Trump's expected shortcomings, on the promises he made to voters, and less on his norm-breaking provocations. Others fear such strategies are an inadequate response to Trump's agenda, including the possibility of deportation camps and investigations into his political enemies. "People are going to die," says Yasmin Raji, the executive director of Swing Left, pointing to cuts on health spending and shifts in immigration policy. "We are not the resistance 2.0. That is not going to be enough." The remedies would not be fast, even if they were obvious. It is foolhardy to think one reason is why we lost and one change will fix it, says Rodel Molyneux, a veteran Democratic strategist. Yet as Democrats brace for the return of Trump's chaos, there's little agreement on where the party's focus should be. Few see either House Leader Hakeem Jeffries or Senate Leader Chuck Schumer as the unifying national figure the party needs. The pair no donors, but are hardly household names. The party will lack a single leader until Democrats anoint their next nominee, and that's probably more than 3 years away. Time Off Movies. It's a short article, but it may be abridged. Essay, "It's Time for the Oscars to Take Horror Seriously," by Megan McCluskey. When Demi Moore won the Golden Globe for her turn in Coralie Fargate's body horror hit The Substance January 5, she shared in her acceptance speech it was the first real award she'd received in her more than 45 years in Hollywood. While recognition of the 62-year-old actor was long overdue, it was perhaps a surprise that it came for a role that involved donning grotesque prosthetics and graphically birthing a younger version of herself, considering horror's grim awards season track record. In the nearly 100 years since the Oscars debuted, a grand total of 7 horror movies, now including The Substance, with Fargate also receiving a nod for Best Director, have been nominated for Best Picture. Only 1991's The Silence of the Lambs, which is also a detective story, has won. A statuette for Moore, who received her first ever nomination January 23, would make her just the 7th actor to receive an Oscar for their role in a horror movie. It's an egregiously low success rate for a genre that's delivered some of film's most memorable performances. And Moore is just the chosen representative of a year that produced many stellar turns in a wide range of scary movies. There was Hugh Grant as a fiendishly charming zealot in Heretic, Naomi Scott as a pop star fighting both literal and figurative demons in Smile 2, and Justice Smith as a shy teen who develops an obsession with a cult horror series in I Saw the TV Glow. Christmas Day release Nosferatu, Robert Eggers' remake of F.W. Murnau's 1922 silent vampire classic, swiftly climbed into the top 50 highest-grossing horror movies of all time as critics heaped praise on star Lily Rose Depp. Though Grant was nominated for a Golden Globe, the others have been largely overlooked. Gory and gruesome, The Substance was never a shoe-in for mainstream success, but a buzzy con debut, a resonant message about aging women, and a box office haul of $76 million on a $17.5 million budget are all testament to how powerful a vehicle horror can be for talented actors. Still, even if Moore ends up on the podium on March 2, it does not change the fact that historically the Academy has made a habit of snubbing some of the most deserving performances. To name just a few from the past decade, Toni Collette in Hereditary, Lupita Nyong'o in Us, Florence Pugh in Midsommar. Despite its undeniable cultural impact, position as the fastest-growing genre at the box office, and heightened critical attention, horror clearly continues to be viewed by many Academy voters as less than, at least as compared with the period dramas and biopics that frequently earn awards glory. If the Academy does not reward those like Moore who are willing to take the horror leap of faith, it tacitly de-incentivizes what she described in her Globes speech as magical, bold, courageous, out-of-the-box, absolutely bonkers performances from some of the best names in the biz. Scary thought, isn't it? That last article was slightly abbreviated, and we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.